Forget what you learned about the origin of printing. Movable type using Chinese porcelain pegs was invented by Bi Sheng in 1040, 4 centuries before Gutenberg and his press. And where there is printing, there is copyright too. Yes, you can forget that other myth, the one that says China and copyright are incompatible. Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Velocity of Content. Pirates and Publishers, A Social History of Copyright in Modern China, maps the everyday life of copyright and piracy in China from the 1890s through the 1950s. The book's author and recipient of the 2020 Peter Gonville Stein Book Award from the American Society for Legal History is Fei-Hsien Wang, Associate Professor of History at Indiana University, Bloomington. Professor Wang joins me now. Congratulations on the award, Professor Wang, and welcome to the program.
Thank you, Chris. It's very nice to be part of this podcast.
Well, we look forward to talking to you about this book. The Stein Book Award is given for the best book in non-U.S. legal history written in English. The citation praised Pirates and Publishers as an exceedingly rigorous, subtle, and well-researched book that has major implications for understanding the interplay among law, society, culture, and politics, not only in modern China, but also in many places with similarly complicated experiences with modernity. And Professor Wang, I'd like to start about this point that the book is described as a social history. Why did you choose copyright as the lens for understanding China and particularly Chinese book culture?
The reason why I decided to describe this work as a social history of copyright instead of a legal history of copyright has two main reasons. First of all, is that coming from a book historian's perspective, I think there is much more about copyright and piracy than legal court cases or the making of copyright law or WTO treaties, Berne Convention, and etc. It captures the heart of knowledge production and book industry in a very intriguing way, because this is not just about the nature of book, what constitutes as a book, who can be the legitimate owner of a book or a work. It also involves the production process, like how are you going to pirate a book and how do you get access of the content? How did the readers or the customers know this is an authentic copy or this is a knockoff? And it's also about the negotiation between, or the interaction between the content producer, the authors, the translators, etc., who provide the content, and the publishers and printers who make the manuscript into actual copies of book. And so I figured this would be a good entry point for me to not only get a better sense of how this knowledge economy and book industry function in a more like multidimensional way.
Well, this important point to Professor Wang about the contrast between Chinese publishing traditions and the Western style approach to those is one that runs throughout the book. But I think we should make sure that listeners understand something about the myths that you seek to dispel around China and copyright. So there are several of these. Tell us what they are.
So there are a few major myths in China and beyond. So for our audiences outside of China, what they may be more familiar with is the rhetoric and the myth about China being now the notorious haven for IPR piracy. This is an indication that the Chinese pirate because they are yet to learn how to fully appreciate this important and seemingly universal modern legal doctrine. And so many believe that the reason why Chinese pirate is because they don't understand or they don't appreciate copyright. And this is because the Chinese culture is one that values tradition and imitation more than innovation and creativity. It's the one that value collective goods more than individual rights. And so as part of this myth would be China, historically speaking, and now, like now and then, it's a country that is yet to establish a firm law and order, especially about copyright. And so in order to solve this piracy problem, external pressure has to come in to persuade or force or urge China to adopt this modern copyright doctrine. So one day, like after Chinese learn to respect copyright, then piracy would disappear and problem solve. This has been the main rhetoric. It's a very similar rhetoric we see all the way from mid-19th century until today when it comes to the issue of Chinese pirating other countries' intellectual property. And another myth about this is that, as you mentioned in your opening remark, another popular myth, mostly for the Chinese, would be China actually was the first country invented copyright, because copyright is so intertwined with the invention of printing. And since China is the first place where movable type was invented, and so naturally China will be the first one developed some sense of a copyright doctrine. And so these are the two main myths I would like to, in a way, challenge and debunk in my book.
Well, and indeed, you make the point that there are two notions of copyright, two words for copyright in Chinese, and that these are really indicators of the deep tradition of copyright in the country. So tell us what those are.
So the English word copyright, or like the broadly speaking, this modern doctrine of copyright that emerged from Western European printing tradition was introduced to China at the turn of the 20th century, late 19th, early 20th century. And it had two translations. They were both originally from Japanese. The first one is in Chinese, banquan, which literally means right to printing block. And this is a phrase that is still popularly used in Chinese nowadays. And as you can sense, it emphasizes the ownership of printing block, and which is deeply rooted in East Asian woodblock printing tradition. And the other translation for copyright is 著作权, which can be translated directly as author's right. And this is derived from the Berne Convention and more European continental notion of author being the creator of his work and thus the exclusive owner of that work. And this was the term that used in most of the copyright law that were promulgated in China throughout the 20th century, but it's less popularly used among publishers and authors until more recently.
Well, indeed, the really important point around the history of copyright in China is to tie it to the history of China. And the period that you cover in the book runs from really the end of the imperial period into the early days of the People's Republic of China, with of course, the Republic of China, the Kuomintang period in the middle. And this is at the very same moment that China really enters into a complex relationship with the West. And so what one sees is the rise of a Western style of learning and a decline or a sort of fading of Chinese approach to learning and education. Why is all of that important?
For people who study modern Chinese intellectual history, this is sort of like a watershed moment. So for thousands of years, the Chinese believed themselves in the pivot of civilization with capital C. But the imperialist aggression that came to China in the second half of the 19th century made Chinese rethought like the value of their traditional knowledge world, and so like the value and the truth and the knowledge they firmly believe to be the best in the world is like completely shaken. And so they will rush the Chinese, educated Chinese, Chinese officials, Chinese government, recognize the need to learn from the West, whom they used to believe to be inferior barbarians. And so there was this urge and anxiety that drove them to rapidly consume whatever like came from the West. And but that's a new, totally new body of knowledge. No one knows how to evaluate them. No one knows how to evaluate them and like who actually published them and et cetera. And that also, it was also during this period, the letterpress and the mechanical printing technology was introduced to China. And so all of a sudden, you not only have a paradigm shift in the intellectual world, and you also have a technological revolution, a printing revolution, if you would like to say that, in China that made the production of book became more diverse and thus less orderly. And so it was during this period of time, like unauthorized reprinting of books became a major issue for authors and translators who produce those new knowledge, as well as publishers and printers who now like all of a sudden lost their inventory because they were no longer, the traditional works were no longer fashionable, and they were all trying to publish the latest popular stuff in order to survive. And also the readers now suddenly encounter this influx of new information and new books. And what they learned in the past about how to tell a book is good or bad, no longer valid. And so it was during this period of time, people got very frustrated about unauthorized printing or like a piracy or pirate edition, as you may see. And then they start to think copyright as a fashionable Western doctrine, maybe the solution to all these problems that they were facing.
Well, what's interesting to me is this sounds familiar, this interaction between social change and technological change leading to a concern around copyright. That sounds like today, practically. But the situation that you tell us about in the book, Professor Wang, is really very different and very particular to China during that period, the beginning of the 20th century. And your research concentrated within the archive of the Shanghai Booksellers Guild. Tell us about the guild and about this unusual collection of artifacts that you explored.
So the group of main actors in my book is the members of Shanghai Booksellers Guild. So Shanghai, since the second half of the 19th century, especially after 1880s, emerges the new cultural and publishing center of China. Mainly because this is where most of the new ideas or Western idea got introduced to China, and partly because it was a treaty port, so it enjoyed more legal freedom. And so the booksellers and publishers in Shanghai were the one that worry about piracy the most, but they were also the most active and notorious pirates themselves. And but during this period of time, late 19th and early 20th century, this is also a time in China where you see constant revolution, civil wars, and so it's constant political upholds. And so you have copyright law, but the central government were fighting for their own survival. So they did not have the capacity, or they did not have the keen interest to protect people's copyright. So the Shanghai booksellers decided to take this business into their own hands. So they utilize this pre-existing traditional mutual aid, also civic organization, the Booksellers Guild, and transformed it into, one would say, sort of like a self-regulation, customary legal mechanism to register their members' new books, to mediate the copyright disputes among members. And the guilds will also, on behalf of its members, to file lawsuits or to punish pirates and persuade or force the pirates to come to a settlement with the authentic publishers and so, et cetera, et cetera. But this is all done outside of the state's legal system. So previously, legal scholars and legal historians who are interested in the history of copyright law in China didn't really pay attention to this particular group and what they have been doing. But since I'm more interested in how the publishers, the authors who may be affected by piracy the most, who may care about copyright more than the rest of the society, I found such organization would be very crucial for me to understand how they enforce and practice and understood copyright in a day-to-day ground level, so in their everyday life. And so that's basically the most important body of archive I use in my book.
Well, you uncovered something fascinating, which is that the guild, the Shanghai Booksellers Guild, had begun a so-called detective branch, and that you uncovered the archives of this detective branch in Shanghai. And I just want you to tell us about these book detectives and how they operated.
Yeah, so it's very similar to what we see nowadays in some of the major, say, pharmaceutical company or like a seed company or like IT companies. They would have their security department and they will hire like also private detectives to uncover piracy schemes, because you cannot rely on the state police to do that for you. And it was the same in China in the 1930s, and especially after the Shanghai publishers dominated the national market of books in China. They realized that they cannot rely on the police to help them discover who is selling pirate edition of their books. So they hire a whole bunch of former policemen, former soldiers, or people with a certain experience in legal professions to hunt down the pirates for them. They will inspect major book markets for the guild, and they will also receive tips from informants. And once they receive certain information that people are pirating certain books, they will either report to the police and with the police company, raid the pirates' operation, confiscated what they believe to be the pirate copies, and file lawsuits on behalf of the guild member. Or sometimes they will set up traps, might pretend to be provincial buyers, and so that they can have a deeper understanding of the whole pirate operation. And then they will again, once they have the raid, and then they will file lawsuits for the guild. But sending pirates to jail was not the detective branch's main goal. Their goal was to force the pirates to settle outside of the court and let the pirates pay the compensation to the original publishers. And in this process, the detective and the guild would be able to ask for a certain percentage of the compensation as their reward. And of course, this is like they operate in the gray zone of the law, and some of their actions were then deemed by the policemen as illegal, and so they would often get into troubles themselves.
Well, operating in the gray zone of the law really does make me think this would make a wonderful television series, The Book Detectives. But, you know, I want to end our interview, Professor Wang, by asking you a personal question after discussing your professional work, which is that you are the daughter of a husband and wife publisher team in China. How did your parents and their work influence you to become a book historian and to take up this topic of copyright?
Yeah, thank you for this question. before I got my PhD, I always thought that I would go back home and take over the family business and become a publisher. But then I realized that what I'm more interested in is, it's always the same. And my personal experience growing up with my parents and seeing them operating as authors, editors, and publishers, they made me realize that the backstories of the book publishing is more interesting than like publishing the book. And so for me, I always see books not just as container of knowledge and information, but they were also commodities and they were complicated, like economic decisions and involved in it. And that would help me understand. So when I read, say, the archive, the authors and publishers' diaries and correspondence, I see my parents. And that also helped me to understand those publishers and authors' world, and that they are also normal human beings who need to pay the rent and feed the children and etc. So that helped me a lot. And I also heard a lot from them and also our family friends who are also in the cultural industry about how they struggle with various pirates in far, far away small towns and etc. And so their experience was the one that inspired me to look beyond the state's formal legal record. Because I know that for a lot of publishers and authors, they would handle such issue outside of the court. And if we only focus on copyright law and treaty negotiation, then we would overlook like a lot of what's really going on underground.
Fei-Shun Wang, Associate Professor of History at Indiana University Bloomington and author of Pirates and Publishers, the winner of the 2020 Gonville Stein Book Award. Thank you so much for joining me today on Velocity of Content.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's my pleasure to be here today.
Our co-producer and recording engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. You can subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening and join us again soon for another podcast from CCC.